Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is a most unusual segment. I know it is for me. When I was a young person, I mean really, really young, I had heard about this area of science called cryonics. And what we were told then was that it's when you freeze people so that they can be revived later and continue to live life. It's obviously more complex than that. The technology has advanced way more than that. And I've invited Ben Best, the CEO and president of the Cryonics Institute, who's been in the industry for 20 plus years, to help explain and clarify what cryonics is, what's happening in the industry, what some of the details are about, so that we have a more familiar understanding with the paradigm behind it, the applications of it, and the opportunity of it. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ben Best to It's Rainmaking Time. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Hi.
When I was led to do a piece on this with you, I first said to myself, you know, why am I doing this? This is so kind of off the beaten track. Then the other part of me said, but this is part of life extension in a different way than we understand it. Can you explain it to the public? What is cryonics?
Well, one way of thinking of it is an ambulance to the future, if it works. We believe that future medicine will be able to rejuvenate people to a youthful condition and cure all diseases. We're not there yet, and the only way we can get there is by putting ourselves in a time capsule, and cryonics is the best time capsule we've got. When you lower people to cryogenic temperatures, minus 321 degrees Fahrenheit, there's essentially no changes happening to your body tissues. And the problem, of course, is that ice formation. You get ice formation if you don't do any treatment. But if you can replace the body water with another solution, another compound, a vitrification solution, we call it, cryoprotectants, you don't get that ice formation. You don't get that freezing damage.
And what is the compound that you use?
Ethylene glycol. It's a mixture of ethylene glycol and DMSO in an isotonic solution.
And what does it do to the body, in essence?
Well, it's just it's substituting for water. Water is going to cause ice to form, and ice is what's damaging. Ice is what damages cells. But if you replace that water with the vitrification solution, then that doesn't happen. It's basically an antifreeze, and these compounds just prevent ice from forming.
How long does it last, and when do you actually do all that? And what's the distinction? I know I'm asking you a lot at one time, but what distinguishes somebody as dead, but for you, they're not really dead? Like, is there legal dead, and then there's body dead? What does it mean?
Yeah, we call them patients. I mean, there was a time, even today, people, emergency medical people distinguish between clinical death and legal death or biological death. And the distinction they're making is between when someone's heart stops and when there's really no hope for a person. And when a person's heart stops, they're clinically dead. If you use a CPR and a defibrillator, very often you can get the heart to start again. So it's just a matter of technology that's changed our perception of what dead is, and we see it as the same thing with cryonics. If we apply our procedures and stop all changes, we're doing something like CPR on a very long, much longer time scale. Human embryos are very small tissues, and it's easy to use cryoprotectants to prevent freezing damage in small tissues. But there are, there's hundreds of, at least 100,000 embryos, human embryos that have been at liquidation temperature and then brought back to develop into a fetus and a baby and a human being, an adult.
So let's take it from the top one more time. There's a difference between clinical and legal death. Clinical death is what? One more time.
That's when the heart stops.
Okay. Now, what if the heart stops but the brain is still active?
Well, the brain may not be active, but the capacity to be active is there. I mean, it's just a matter of starting the heart again and keeping the brain functioning. When the heart stops, the brain doesn't suddenly explode, and the idea that the brain is destroyed after 6 minutes is incorrect. But
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Well, what is true is that the longer you go past 6 minutes, the greater the likelihood and the greater the degree of neurological damage that ultimately happens. But that's ultimate. That can take a long time. It isn't immediate. And the point is to, even after an hour or more than that, the neurons actually take, even after 6 hours, only 15% of the neurons are dead. So the structure is there. The point is to preserve the structure. The idea of death is a legal concept. You know, it's good to have some strong line where you can say this is dead, this is alive. But in truth, it's a process. Decomposition is something that goes over a period of days and weeks, actually, as the tissues become more and more of a mush and less and less of something that has a capacity for life.
So, for example, when someone dies or is clinically dead, and they're put into a refrigerator, that doesn't mean that they're still alive on a brain level, right?
Well, there are people who are subject, have been given low temperature surgery, and there have been dog experiments where dogs have been made very hypothermic, down to 10 degrees Celsius or something like that over a period of an hour or two. And they can be brought back. And as I say, with this hypothermic surgery, they're just slowing that. Every 10 degrees Celsius that you drop, the metabolism is cut in half. And the metabolic rate at 4 degrees Celsius, the refrigerator temperature, is about 1/18 what it is at body temperature. So the more you slow things down, the more you slow down the degradation process. Now, refrigerator temperature isn't cold enough to certainly keep a person preserved for centuries. It'll keep your food from going bad, but for the time frame that we're looking at, and we hope it isn't centuries, one century at the most, we want very much lower temperatures, cryogenic temperatures, liquid nitrogen temperatures. Is what we use, and liquid nitrogen is very cheap, and also we pay about 12.5 cents a liter, so we can keep a person cryopreserved for $100 a year, hopefully for as long as necessary.
Wow. So how does the families of people who are being cryogenically preserved say goodbye? In other words, the whole process is they're gone, but they're not.
Yeah.
It's a different mindset completely.
Well, I suppose, people say goodbye when a loved one goes overseas on vacation or something like that, for 2 weeks. There might be even if someone goes off on a long trip, it might be an even more profound and tearful goodbye. And in this case, it might be centuries or decades, so it's an even longer goodbye. But it isn't. There's a difference between goodbye for a week, goodbye for a month, goodbye for years, and goodbye forever. So, many of our members who preserve their parents, they preserve their spouses, or they're preserved with their spouses or family members. So the goodbye is not, it's just we'll meet again kind of a goodbye.
And the question also is, when they are brought back, and I'm going to speak it as if they will be, because with the law of accelerating returns that Ray Kurzweil talks about, it very well be, and I guess with the assistance of nanotechnology in human systems, it looks like it may not be even 25 years. It may be before that. But when they're brought back, do they have memory of anything?
Well, we believe that memory is, that the function of the brain is to save memories. So if you preserve the brain well, the memory should be there.
So the person would come back and they would remember who they are and what their name is and their identity as if in a deep sleep.
Yes, it's exactly. That's the idea. Yeah. It's just like, as I say, it's the same thing that happens with hypothermic surgery. When you sleep, you have brain waves, but during hypothermic surgery, when people are cooled down and given barbiturates, it's similar. There's no brain waves. But on the other hand, the person can still be warmed up again or recover and have the brain waves return.
Or have there been people that have ever been afraid of you and your work and the work of cryonics?
Well, yeah. There's a lot of people just don't want to think of death. I can remember, I guess many people have it to various degrees. I guess it's like looking at the sun. You know the sun is there, but you don't want to stare at it. I can remember, there was a fellow here once, it's just an extreme example. We had a coffin on display, and he couldn't stand the fact there was a coffin there. He didn't like the idea. I mean, I must admit I had to get used to it myself, but just thinking about death, I mean, I love life. That's why I got involved in this, and then to suddenly be surrounded by images of death and having to deal with what is conventionally viewed as death, it was not very appetizing to me, but I seem to have gotten used to it to some extent.
Is part of the paradigm of cryonics to beat death?
Well, some people think that you can. I mean, in my mind, it's more to postpone it. Some people believe that in physical immortality and think that cryonics as a means to achieving physical immortality. I don't happen to be one of those people. I think we can maybe postpone death by hundreds or thousands of years, perhaps, but I think sooner or later something's going to get you. You know, a meteor is going to hit you or your spaceship's going to fly into a star or something.
But, or an ice age.
Whatever. But I think sooner or later, cryonics is just, it's just like, like a heart transplant. Heart transplants once made people think of Frankenstein, but people don't think about Frankenstein now when they talk about heart transplants. So it's a bit of getting used to. But on the other hand, a heart transplant just gives you more years. It doesn't give you immortality. I think the same is true for cryonics. It's just another technique to extend your life.
In the book, I guess it's a three-volume text called Nanomedicine, is it Robert Freitas?
That's correct, yeah.
Said that he wouldn't be surprised if the first cryonics revival was attempted by 2040 to 2050. Do you think that, or do you think it could happen before?
Well, I think that may be a reasonable, it's an optimistic guess. It's a little more optimistic than I usually say 50 years. Which is, it's not that much further than what he's saying. But anyway, the first revival will be of people preserved under technologies that are a lot better than what we have now. It's a LIFO process, last in, first out. The people who come out first will be the ones who've been preserved under the most advanced technologies, which we don't have currently.
Why is that policy like that?
Well, it's not a policy. I'm just saying that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that as technology improves,
yes,
you improve your ability to preserve people, to preserve them with a minimum amount of damage, and one of the major problems we're dealing with now is cryoprotectant toxicity. These antifreeze compounds are toxic, and so hopefully the technology will advance to make less toxic antifreeze compounds.
Or non-toxic,
and if we could have totally non-toxic cryoprotectants, then we pretty well be there with reversible cryopreservation.
Do you think nanotechnology will help with that?
No, I don't. It's different, something different. It's not going to be. If we had reversible cryopreservation today to suspended animation, they wouldn't. That would only be part of the problem. That we need to address the problem of curing all diseases and especially the disease of aging. One of our members is 100 years old. One of our patients is 100 years old. Doesn't want to come back as a person who's 100 years old. He wants to be rejuvenated. So that's only part of the puzzle. We have to be able to rejuvenate people to the prime of life, or at least, you know, to a fairly youthful condition before attempting to bring them back.
It's interesting. We will need a revolution in 21st century diagnostics. I interviewed Dr. Art Robinson, who has been working on a whole new paradigm and structural apparatus for 21st century diagnostics to miniaturize them and quicken and actually put them in the care and in the dominion of regular people. And I did an interview with him. It was fascinating. But between this and the work that Ray Kurzweil and his associates are doing in life extension and in nanotechnology and the law of accelerating returns and just the kind of stuff that's at work, it really could happen.
Well, that's what I think. That's why I'm doing this.
But what about the philosophical and spiritual side of this? What about for the people that say, look, by doing this, you're acting as a creator? You're actually interfering with the creator's plan for that being. What do you think?
There were people who said that about heart transplants, as I mentioned before. You know, that heart transplants are, you know, mucking around with Mother Nature. Actually, some people even said that about trains, and, you know, there was a lot of resistance to a lot of mechanization. And it's just a general fear of progress in a way, I think. If we're mucking around, we've been given the intelligence to advance our technology and to improve our condition. We should use it to the fullest. I mean, we're not mucking around with Mother Nature. We are mucking around with Mother Nature by using penicillin to cure various diseases. So why not, you know, carry on the disease curing process and cure the disease of aging?
I get that. I totally get that. But you know how most people think, well, you have a life. People have an expectation of trying to live beyond 70.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? There's like a subconscious thing. They hope to live beyond 70 and live as close to 100. But I think there's something subconscious in most people that they prepare to not have quality of life from 70 to 100.
Yeah, well, 200 years ago, people were living about half as long as they are now. So it hasn't been... And maybe 200 years ago, people were prepared to live half as long. So the change has been fairly slow, and people have gotten used to it, I suppose. No one has protested that it's sacrilegious. I mean, if you take the Bible literally, Methuselah lived 969 years, and a lot of the early biblical figures lived centuries. So there wasn't any problem with that. In terms of eternity, another thousand years, more or less, really is just a blink of an eye.
And what do you think about the globalists and the people who are against population growth? This is an antithetical model, I guess, in thinking for that.
Well, a more serious population problem is reproduction. The people living longer doesn't create as great a population growth as reproduction does.
That's a good point.
But you know, so that could be where the emphasis is. But on the other hand, at one time it was believed that there was the iron law of wages that said that population could never increase, that there could never be economic improvement because the population would always increase every time there's a gain in productivity, but that just hasn't happened. Productivity has outstripped population in the developed world, maybe not the undeveloped world, but I think technology can solve all sorts of problems. I mean, the people who get involved in this are ones who believe in the capacity of technology to solve problems. Obviously, if technology can solve the problems of aging and death, technology can solve the problems of population, overpopulation, of pollution in particular, and production of food and resources and medicines. There's no, you know, and there's really the world actually has a lot of space. The oceans are uninhabited. There's vast uninhabited regions of our continents, and space is just has a vast amount of living space.
Actually, I was told by somebody who passed away a few months ago that you could take all the people in the world and fit them in Texas.
Well, you could fit them all. You could fit them all in a cubic mile in the Grand Canyon too. It'd be kind of crowded, but
yeah. But I'm just to get a perspective of how much space there is. He told me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it's interesting. So back to cryonics. Somebody.
Well, if you build higher and higher skyscrapers too, you can crowd a lot more people into a smaller space.
True. Okay. So. Somebody has just, their heart has stopped, and they have a legal cryonics order. What happens? Take us through the process.
Well, ideally, there's a team standing there that is going to place that person in an ice bath to cool them as quickly as possible. Ice water will cool much more quickly than ice cubes. It's more greater thermal conductivity, and then you apply a heart-lung machine of some kind, which will basically the same effect of artificial CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. You can ventilate the person. So in that case, there's no six minutes elapsed anyway. You know, you're acting really almost instantaneously. So people worry about the six-minute limit. That doesn't apply in this case because you're starting the circulation again to keep the cells alive, and also you're cooling to slow the metabolism. And every 10 degrees you cool, you cut the metabolic rate in half, which cuts any degradation in half. And then that's an exponential cooling process. Exponential process of reduced metabolism as you cool further, and then when you get down to around 10 degrees Celsius, then you can replace the person's. We do surgery and cannulate the vessels. In our case, we try to cannulate the carotids and the jugulars or the carotids, or we go in through the aorta. In any case, we try to replace, especially in the brain, we try to replace the water with this antifreeze solution. And then once that's accomplished, then we put the person into a cooling box. We don't just drop them in liquination. And under computer control, we cool them down to liquid nitrogen temperature in such a way as to minimize thermal stress, but at the same time cool quickly in the first part to reduce the effect of any cryoprotectant toxicity. And then once the person's at liquidation temperature, and that process takes nearly a week, then we place them in liquid nitrogen in these big thermos bottle-like containers that they're like a thermos bottle. They've got the patients and the liquid nitrogen in the middle, like keeping coffee warm, in this case keeping cold with a vacuum around it, as in a thermos bottle, to provide the best insulation. And we use actually a vacuum and perlite. And so they're completely, the process is completely passive. If there's a power failure, there's no electricity relied on in this case. If there's a power failure, it doesn't affect us because we're using this liquidation coolant. And so hopefully every week for our efficient cryostats, we top them off with more liquid nitrogen. And as I say, we can spend about $100 a year keeping a person cryopreserved. And most people, it's not cheap. It's, you know, the very least you can pay is about $30,000. But most people just buy a life insurance policy and name us as the beneficiary of the policy. So, it isn't as if they have to have the money in their pockets.
And I understand that there's only a few people in the country who have a niche to sell that. There are several companies that will provide the insurance, but there's very few people who actually sell it as a niche. Am I correct or incorrect?
Well, there's one guy in particular who's made it his specialty. So he may be driving the others off the market. He's really very good. Rudy Hoffman in Florida. And he sells about 85% of the insurance policies. I mean, that's because when people come to us and say, what agents do we use? And we send them to him. But we've got one of our directors also sells insurance. And there's Jim Yunt with the American Cryonic Society also is an insurance agent. So there's others. It's just that one guy seems to have done such a good job and gotten so much expertise at this that he's basically captured the largest part of the market.
I think it's interesting that the insurance companies will do it. I would imagine it's cheaper for them than life insurance policies, isn't it?
I'm not understanding what.
Well, I mean, it is
life insurance policy.
It is a life insurance policy.
It's a life insurance policy that names the cryonics organization as a beneficiary. And it's just, you know, they don't lose money on the deal, and just because we don't regard them as dead, the people who make cryonics arrangements don't live any less long than other people on average, and if anything, they probably live longer because they tend to want to really cling to life anyway, and so they tend to be more health conscious by and large. And so it's actually good. The insurance companies actually have a good deal with selling life insurance to cryonics people.
Very interesting. And are the people, when they go into these vacuum tubes, are they undressed or do they have any type of material that they're wearing?
We put them in a sleeping bag partly as padding, just protection so they don't, you know, aren't bumping up against things and so forth. It's protective, and they're tied to a board. They're not just flopping around. That we put them in upside down with their head down, and we don't want them flopping to the bottom. We want to be able to put six of them in, and so they're tied to boards. And the reason their head is down is, if some disaster should happen, and it would take several weeks, quite a few weeks, if there's no liquid nitrogen, but at least their head would be the last thing to be thawed out if if there was, you know, if there was some disaster that prevented us from getting more liquid nitrogen for a period of over a month or so.
Now, when they're in these vacuums, at the point they're in the vacuums, they have no heartbeat and they have no brain activity, correct?
Yeah, and you know, as they say, at that kind of temperature, when the colder things get, the slower that any molecular motion is. And so, you know, they're getting very close to stopped. You know, as you get down to, you know, molecular motion and atomic motion virtually stops when you get down to zero. It's not zero Kelvin, I mean, minus 273. But anyway, they're at minus 196 Celsius.
I have another question. You know how people have been known to come out of comas all of a sudden?
Okay.
What if somebody woke up out of this as if out of a coma?
Well, they're not going to do that at liquid nitrogen temperature. There's no waking up of this at that temperature. You've got to wake up, you've got to have some electrical and molecular activity in your brain. And as I say, at that temperature, there's nothing is moving. You know, it's like you're solid as a rock. There's no motion whatsoever. The electrical signals that normally give you consciousness would not be able to exist at that temperature.
So could you say, I'm just asking you for your own sense, having been in this industry and in the business for many, many years, is life part of electrical activity? Aren't we electrical?
I'm not quite sure what you're saying.
It's more like a question.
The way the brain works is that we have our brains are full of neurons, and the neurons' consciousness is associated with signals passing from one neuron to the other through axons and synapses.
Right, but I just thought it was interesting that you were talking about the electrical part. Are we electrical? You ever heard of the book, The Body Electric?
No.
You never heard of that book?
No.
You should read that book. It would definitely be an interesting book for you.
Okay.
So what happens with the families of the person? Do you operate as a cemetery, or you have a cemetery license?
Well, this is the way the state of Michigan has chosen to regulate us, and this is the category they've chosen to regulate us under. We, from my point of view, we are not a cemetery. We are a hospital, and we're caring for patients. But from a legal point of view, we are a cemetery in the sense that all the patients we're caring for are legally dead by the conventional definitions of death. So as far as the families are concerned, we have little boxes for flowers. Since we're a cemetery, some people do come and put flowers, but I guess people go to hospitals and give flowers to people lying in the hospital as much as they do in cemeteries. So you can look at it from that point of view.
Has the business grown over the last 10, 20 years? Are people becoming more open to life extension in the literal sense?
I believe so. The life extension business, I believe, has grown terrifically more rapidly than the cryonics business. The cryonics growth really was improved and increased by, at least for our company, for the Cryonics Institute, there was a big jump in growth when the internet became available, because people really weren't finding us very well or hearing about us or learning about us or understanding what cryonics was all about by other means. But now we can make all that information available on the internet, and people can hear about us and go searching for us on the internet. And their website is cryonics.org. And if your listeners that want to learn about us are certainly welcome to come and look at all the information we have on our website. And so once the internet came along, there was a big growth spurt, but for the last almost a decade, the growth hasn't been exponential. That's what you might think about the growth of life extension. I think the life extension industry as a whole has grown exponentially, but as far as Cryonix is concerned, it's grown, but it's grown linearly. It's a straight line rather than exponentially, an upward sloping curve. It's not curved. It just seems to be, we seem to get about the same number of new members each year. So it's nice that we're growing. We are growing, but it's not like what the singularity people talk about. And maybe something will happen, there'll be some change of perception, something's going to happen, and it will start to become exponential. I hope so, but at the moment, we seem to get about the same number of new people, new members each year.
I think what's also part of the complexity surrounding Cryonix is that most people have a fixed mindset about lifespan for themselves, or what they've heard, or what they've come to expect. And so the thought of wanting to be around in the future and to be part of a future beyond a traditional life course is already a stretch. And then to not close this chapter and say, when my heart stops and I'm, quote, legally pronounced dead, I have the option to go into suspended animation. And with improvement with medicine and science, to come back. And to even have that thought, that mindset, is something that I would imagine 9 out of 10 people don't even know can happen, A. B, would be probably hard-pressed or a little challenged about it, just because it's not familiar. It's a foreign paradigm. And then there's this whole thing about what I asked you in the beginning, what makes somebody dead, and could they come out like they could a coma? And you explained that really well.
Well, one of the questions I ask people to see what their possible potential interest is would be in cryonics. One of the questions I very often ask is, if you could live as long as possible, how long would you like to live? And very often the answer I hear is, I've never thought about it.
That's a great question.
Yeah, and although a lot of people just it doesn't occur to them, and a lot of them it doesn't occur to them. Also, it's a very foreign concept for most people. The idea that aging can be eliminated, or that rejuvenation is possible, and that's a pretty key part of the whole program. You know, if you think you're going to come back as a decrepit old person, it's not going to be very appealing to you.
In a way, to be willing to go through the cryonics process is to hedge and to bet on present and future discoveries and medical breakthroughs and science breakthroughs and health breakthroughs and life extension breakthroughs, so that rejuvenation and youthfulness and health are the norm.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
And that's really what it is. It's a bet, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It's a bet. It's also a belief too. It's not just a pig and a poke. I think someone who understands what the molecular basis of diseases and the molecular basis of aging can understand that these are just forms of damage, and that they're forms of damage that can potentially be repaired.
Very exciting when you think about it. Of course, it then brings this whole series of other questions, which is that the science and the technology and everything evolves. And then the person was pronounced dead, right? A death certificate is given. but let's say 30 years from now, are revived, but the system may or may not recognize them as revived. There will need to be some legal work provisioned for now and in the next 10 years for that person's status coming into the world again.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, that doesn't sound awesomely challenging. I mean, there might be some question. There is some question about property rights and things like that. There's people who try to protect their property while they're dead, and legally, of course, they can't have any property because they're dead. So they try to.
Can be done in trust. I more meant that.
Yeah.
I'm not so much talking about that, though. That's an interesting aspect. I was more talking about their status of returning, and they return, but their social security number can't be used. They're not really being born. They're in this new status.
Yeah. Well,
they're going to have to be a language for that status.
Yeah.
Right?
Doesn't seem that different from being born to me.
I know what you're saying, but I mean, to the rest of the world, they are what we call returning.
Yeah. Well,
I think
that's pretty low on the list of worries. More people more often worry about how they will adjust to society coming back to a world that seems very alien. And that's actually a reason that I hear often that for people not being interested. So, myself, I've made a lot of big moves to different areas, made big moves where I didn't know people and had to meet new people and things like that. It's just a matter of many people today can come here from third world countries and learn to adapt and enjoy it and not be too stressed out, enjoy all the technology, enjoy all the conveniences that they never had before. And I think it will be similar in the future. People who get involved in cryonics get to know a lot of other people involved in cryonics. And so, I'm not worried that if I came back, I wouldn't know anyone.
well, that's you.
Yeah, but I mean, people can bring their families, you know, try to persuade their families to sign up and their friends. So they won't be alone if that's a concern to them, or they want special people to be with them when they come back. As I say, the founder of this organization, Robert Hettinger, has two wives and his mother preserved. So he's hoping to see them again.
Now he's in his 90s, isn't he?
91 years old. Yeah.
91. He would be great to talk to. The Institute has been around how long?
It was formed in 1976. Robert Hettinger was one of the founders. He's also pretty well the founder of the whole cryonics movement with his 1964 book, The Prospect of Immortality.
Wow. How big do you think the movement is now?
Well, it's fairly easy to estimate the number of people who have made arrangements. It's about 1,300 people who have made arrangements to be cryopreserved. There's a lot of people who have it in their mind to do it. The number of people who are actually stored, being preserved, is still under 200. There are many people who are sympathetic to the idea more than the ones that are signed up. So it depends on how you define the movement. And now there are a lot of actually young people these days. It happens more and more. They seem to think that singularity is coming and aging will be eliminated within their lifetimes, so they don't need to worry about cryonics. But of course, you can die at any time, it's really best to make arrangements when you're young, because if elimination of aging and rejuvenation and all that doesn't happen, within 50 years, they might find themselves unable to buy life insurance at an affordable price, and it may be more difficult for them to make arrangements.
Are there scientists and doctors who are at work on trying to advance the technology and the science for cryonics so that it gets better?
Yeah, there's two directions that comes from. One direction is the reanimation part, the nanotechnology part, which I think is, from my own point of view, it's premature to be working on that. I think it's a bit of a pipe dream to be trying to develop that science at this stage of technology. In the future, it'll be a lot different. I think the emphasis at the moment should be on preserving structure as best as possible. And I think that's where the best science is being done, to improve the cryoprotectants, make them less toxic, make them better able to preserve. And what my own organization is, the research we're investing in at the moment is research aimed at improving the ability to perfuse people, get cryoprotectants in them after they've suffered a certain amount of damage, ischemic damage, we call it, problems with getting our antifreeze solutions to go through the blood vessels. There are ways to do that, ways to improve our ability to perfuse, and so all this is related to preserving structure as best as possible. For future technology, that's where I think the emphasis should be, and that's the kind of research that we're doing, and it's the kind of research I support.
Are you getting help though with it?
Getting help?
Yeah. In other words, are you getting help and funding to try to come up with these protectants?
Well, as far as improving the protectants, there are other organizations that are working on that. Cryobiologists are doing that kind of work. It isn't just cryonics people who are interested in these kinds of problems. There's other tissues, stem cells and embryos and so forth, and cryobiologists are working to improve the preservation of. And so there's a lot of people working on this science that aren't interested in cryonics, but the science they do is can benefit us. What they learn will benefit us. The part about improving the ability to perfuse ischemically damaged patients is something that other scientists are not particularly interested in, and that's something that we have to finance ourselves. But I'm pretty pleased with that work. As I say, the stem cells, there's a great deal of interest in cryopreserving stem cells. So that's attracted a lot of cryobiologists to improve cryoprotectants.
And this is worldwide, isn't it? There's cryonics in Europe, Belgium, Australia, Russia, Netherlands, UK.
As far as organizations doing storage, though, it's only in the United States and Russia. The CryoRust, they've got 11 people in Russia. And apart from that, almost all the other 200 are in the United States. We have members in various areas, many members in Europe and Australia and so forth. There's really nothing thus far. We have some members in Japan, but we've had Oriental, some of our patients are of Oriental heritage, but we've never actually preserved someone from Asia.
Interesting. What is the distinction between the Cryonics Institute and an organization like Alcor? What is your relationship? And it's a very small community, and I just wondered if you would share that.
Yeah, those are the two big organizations doing storage. Those are the two organizations doing storage in the United States. Well, the Alcor has they charge higher prices. A lot of the price difference is because their price includes standing by the bedside, and we don't include that in our price. if people want to have somebody standing by the bedside. You know, I was talking about standing by the bedside and putting somebody in an ice bath and all that. People will have to make arrangements. There's an organization in Florida that many of our members contract with, including myself, called Suspend Animation, that does nothing but in terms of the crying service they provide, but stand by the bedside. So if you combine that price with our price, you get a price that's closer to Alcor's price. So that accounts for a lot of the price difference. Alcor has a lot larger staff than we do. It has about twice as many people signed up for the process as we do. It's actually got fewer patients in storage than we do.
Let's say somebody in California is pronounced clinically dead and they have signed on for cryonics. What happens next if these organizations are in different parts of the country? What happens?
Well, we use funeral directors. Funeral directors do shipping. That's what they do professionally. And Alcor has to work through funeral directors if they want to ship a body from one state to another, because the people are legally dead. It's best to be very close to the organization and not have to spend a day or two in ice being shipped from one state to another. At least at that temperature, there's a reduction in the amount of damage. It isn't like shipping at body temperature, which you're shipping in ice. As far as the standby, Alcor standby teams will go all over the United States, and suspended animation will go all over the United States. The coverage in other countries is a little more difficult for all these organizations.
At the end of the day, though, I can understand if they have standby, but at the end of the day, if you don't have standby, isn't there a bit of an X factor with the funeral directors if they don't do what you tell them to do?
Yeah, some funeral directors are better than others. It's, you know, some funeral directors, Robert Ettinger with his second wife actually had the funeral directors acting as a standby team. He paid them $1,000 a year retainer, and when his wife had her stroke and was terminal, was able to have the funeral director there and apply cardiopulmonary support and ice water cooling. So,
wow, interesting. Very, very interesting.
It's hard, you know. Some funeral directors are really good, and some aren't. So you can't really. We encourage our members to get to know their funeral director.
I would say that in the entire process you're talking about, that is the X factor right there.
Well, yeah. It can be. It
probably takes a cooperative team.
Yeah, that's true.
I had a question about the accidental or violent death of somebody. If somebody has experienced a trauma which moves them into clinical death, are they still able to go through cryonics?
Well, it's when someone dies suddenly, then there's no prospect for standby. They're going to be preserved under worse conditions than if there was a standby. This all matters of degree. As I say, I think the idea that a person's brain self-destructs after 6 minutes is mistaken. I think the experiments done with rodents has shown that brain cells remain viable for, I mean, they don't actually even start, only about 15% of them are actually dead after after 6 hours. So after 12 hours or so, I think it gets to be up to 65%. But it's, as I say, the breaking down of tissue and the breaking down of cellular structure is something that happens over a long period of time. It isn't something that's as rapid as people think. And so I think that if you can, even if a person is gone for a period of time and not been cooled immediately, I think there's still hope for them.
Interesting. The source of your information, how long ago did you find that out, that the six-hour rule may not be true?
Well, the six-minute rule.
Six-minute rule, excuse me.
Well, I mean, I don't know about when I found out. It's hard to say. It's a matter of when particular experiments were done. I'd have to look at the papers. I think the one experiment I had in mind was the mouse experiments was done in 1994. But Peter Safar, the guy who invented cardiopulmonary resuscitation, was doing experiments in dogs as long as 20 or 30 years ago. I'm not sure. It was maybe even 1976 he did those kinds of experiments with cooling dogs and having dogs survive for much longer, recover from much longer than a six-minute period just by improving his perfusion techniques and overcoming the no reflow phenomenon. Part of the six-minute problem is that blood doesn't move as readily, doesn't move as easily, it doesn't move as easily after 6 minutes. It just the white blood cells start sticking to the walls more and that sort of thing. And Peter Safar discovered means of overcoming some of those problems in dogs with plasma expanders and epinephrine and stuff like that. Things that are used in advanced cardio resuscitation at the moment. I don't know. I'm not really answering your question.
No, that's okay. First of all, I want to thank you for taking your time today and giving us an hour of your time to discuss your work in cryonics and what it's about and to inform the listeners. Is there anything else you wish to share with the people who listen to It's Rainmaking Time? Is there anything that is important to you to tell the audiences?
That there's lots of information out there on the web if you want to learn more. Just Google cryonics FAQ for frequently asked questions about cryonics, or just Google cryonics and look at what the cryonics organizations have to say, or whatever.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with Ben Best, the president of the Cryonics Institute, who's been in the business for over 20 years in a most interesting and rarefied field. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Kim.